Good morning, I'm Marcy Criven, and you're tuned to a live broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute. In just a moment, we will join a discussion called Money and Politics. Again, corporate support for Aspen Public Radio's coverage of the Aspen Institute Ideas Festival broadcasts comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisory firm that works with individuals, corporations, and foundations with offices in Aspen and Denver. More at obermeyerwood.com. And we'll head right to the talk from the Aspen Institute campus. This is the Aspen Ideas Festival, a talk called Money and Politics.
Welcome. My name is James Bennett. I'm the president and editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, and I'm extremely excited to have these two great lawyers, great legal minds, with us this morning to talk about the foundations of our campaign finance system, the state of our campaign finance system, the future of that system. David Boies is chairman of Boies, Schiller, and Flexner, and he's held that position since 97. He's, of course, known for the many high-profile cases he's argued over the years, including his role as special trial counsel for the Department of Justice in the antitrust suit against Microsoft, and has served as lead counsel for former Vice President Al Gore during the Florida recount. He's got accolades and tributes that are far too numerous to list here. And the same, of course, can be said of Ted Olson, and should be said of Ted Olson. He's a partner in Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, where he serves on the firm's executive committee, served as Solicitor General of the United States from 2001 to 2004, and has argued, I think, 61 times before the Supreme Court on questions from the separation of powers to immigration to Gore v. Bush, a case on which he was on the opposite side from David Boies. These two are, of course, probably most famous for the work they've done together. Their successful fight to get Proposition 8, California's ban on gay marriage, overturned, struck down by the high court. They wrote about the fight they waged together in Redeeming the Dream, the case for marriage equality, and they spoke about it last night here. I think it's actually particularly wonderful that they bring that history of shared purpose here this morning, because before we even begin, it demonstrates an important point about campaign finance. This is one issue where people who hold one position really tend to assume that the person who holds the opposite position is either profoundly benighted or is acting only out of political expediency. And the fact is that there are people of principle on both sides of this question, because there are real questions of principle in tension, if not in conflict here. The ways we pay for politics in this country are defined by this pretty baffling and eye-glazing series of interlocking mazes of congressional statutes and federal regulations and state laws and court cases. But those all sit on top of really foundational questions about free speech and corruption, the relationship of the citizen to the state, the relationships of citizens to each other. And those are the ideas I'm hoping we're going to draw out, elucidate in the course of this conversation, and then also talk a little bit about, a lot about where the system we now have is going to take us and how it might evolve further. We're going to do about half hour, 40 minutes of conversation here, and then I'm going to open it up to you guys from the floor for questions. We'll have a couple of mics circulating. The fact is that the way we pay for politics now is changing to a degree we really haven't seen since Watergate, or probably in a century. And so it's really important to try to get at the basic ideas here. And Citizens United is not the only reason for the shift that's underway, but it's probably the best place to start. And what Citizens United did was to overturn a ban on soft money that the McCain-Feingold legislation had put in place. But in doing that, the court took the highly unusual step of overturning a previous precedent a ruling in 1990 in the case of Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce, which found that limits on politicking by corporations didn't violate the First Amendment. But in Citizens United, the majority, it was a 5-4 decision, the majority was kind of incensed by this restriction. Justice Kennedy wrote that the censorship we confront is vast in its reach. And Ted, maybe to begin with you, why does this make sense? Why, for purposes of politics, are corporations the same thing as ordinary citizens?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to talk about what the Citizens United case isn't about. It didn't restrict the statute that was involved there that the court was considering was a restriction on independent expenditures by corporations. And it made it a crime for a corporation to be involved, any corporate money to be involved, with respect to a speech an advertisement or a broadcast or some communication that had corporate money involved in it during certain periods of time running up to federal elections. The restriction that was involved covered all corporations. Remember, it made it a crime, and it covered big corporations, small corporations, profit corporations, nonprofit corporations, corporations like the Citizens United, which was a small ideological nonprofit corporation. They were in the business of talking about politics. That's all they did. They were not a for-profit corporation. In other corporations that were embraced by the prohibition would include the ACLU or the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Any corporation, any size, any place was covered by the prohibition. Books, magazines, any kind of communication. So what the court had to confront, first of all, is did these corporations have a right under the First Amendment to engage in speech? The Supreme Court said speech about politics, speech about elections, is at the very, very core of the First Amendment. It is maybe if for no other reason we have a First Amendment to protect people that want to talk about politics, who gets elected, how we're governed. That is what it's at the core. The First Amendment's been extended to things like protests at funerals, advertising, nude dancing, everything, but at the core of the First Amendment is speech about politics. So the court had to confront, is a corporation different? And what the Supreme Court said, well, that really has been decided. The Supreme Court listed maybe 20 or 30 different cases over the years in which the Supreme Court has recognized that corporations have rights under the First Amendment. The First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law. It doesn't say that applies to this group or that group. So the Supreme Court said the famous case of New York Times versus Sullivan or the United States versus New York Times, the Pentagon cases, papers case, all of those involved corporations. Corporations have rights not to have their property seized. They have rights not to have people violate the Fourth Amendment and go and search the corporate treasury books and so forth. So I don't know if I'm going on too long, but I wanted to explain the context that there is a long history of respecting the constitutional rights of people when they get together in a labor union or a nonprofit corporation or a for-profit corporation.
Well, so David, could you respond to that? If in fact corporations are entitled to these other rights of citizenship, why shouldn't they be also entitled to the most fundamental right?
I think there are a couple of lines of authority, and Justice Stevens in his dissent goes through a very long history going all the way back to the early 1800s. In which corporations were treated very differently from people in connection particularly with campaign financing. So I think that while the Chief Justice and Justice Kennedy talk a lot about certain cases in which corporations, particularly media corporations, who have the benefit of the freedom of the press provision of the First Amendment, were entitled to protection like New York Times against Sullivan, there was a long history of treating corporations different than people. As Ted said, the purpose of the First Amendment is to allow people to participate in the political process. And corporations are not people. Corporations may be owned by people. Corporations may employ people. But corporations are an entity created by law. They don't bleed. They don't eat. They don't vote. And there is a significant distinction between a corporation and a person, and everybody knows that. Now, that doesn't mean that corporations don't have rights. What it means is that when you're looking at those rights, you can't forget that corporations are different than people, and particularly for-profit corporations are quite different than people. If you have an individual who has a political view that they want to express, they can go express it. When a corporation expresses a view, the corporation is owned by its shareholders. And some of those shareholders may agree with that view, and some of those shareholders may disagree with that view. And whatever the corporation is doing is commercial. The corporation, the for-profit corporation, has no purpose other than to earn a return for its shareholders. Now, in order to earn a return for its shareholders, it often will take political positions that will be in the interests of the company and its shareholders. But you can't ignore the fact that this is a commercial enterprise, not a political enterprise. And I think that the first mistake that the court makes the majority makes in Citizens United, is to confuse people with corporations. I think the second mistake that it makes is to confuse speech and money. Money is not speech. Money enables speech, facilitates speech, but many things do that. Education does that. Location does that. You don't confuse the thing that helps enable speech with speech itself. I think that if the court had decided the case the way Ted originally briefed it, which was to say that this speech that was being engaged in, this publication, this movie, was something that was protected. And it could have been protected under either free speech or freedom of the press. If all they had said was that was protected, we wouldn't be having quite the conversation we're having today. We're having this conversation because what the court did in a way that I think was quite unprudential, the court ordinarily tries only to answer the question in front of it. Here, instead of just answering that question, it on its own said, come back and re-argue this case, arguing whether there's any limitation on what corporations can spend. I think that was a mistake, and I think that led it to make a decision that really doesn't express an understanding of what corporations are. And I think that partly reflects the fact that most of the people on the court have never really practiced law, never really practiced corporate law, never dealt with corporations, never dealt with what corporations do, never dealt with, for example, shareholder democracy issues. And all of those kinds of issues, I think, would have had a chance to be explicated if the court had followed a more prudential approach and taken it a step at a time.
There are two points in there I'd like you to respond to.
I was going to respond to three.
All right. Take it away.
One, it's impossible to distinguish between freedom of speech and freedom of the press. The Constitution, First Amendment, speaks of Congress shall make no law inhibiting freedom of speech or of the press. And you can't distinguish these days between a media corporation, which is the media corporations own this business and that business and other businesses, and blogs are press or blogs are speech and that sort of thing. So the Supreme Court's made it pretty clear that you can't isolate out something that's engaged in what might be called journalism or advocacy in the form of a press, or there's printing presses and there's pamphlets and there's all of those things. So the freedom of speech and freedom of the press have to be treated the same way, I submit. Secondly, David makes the point, and the debate between the majority and the dissent in the case was, is money speech?
Right.
And I would make the point, and I think the majority did, and we could talk about this for a long time, but neither is this microphone speech, neither is a billboard speech, neither is a picket speech, a pamphlet, a sign, whatever. What we're talking about is communication of thoughts, ideas, arguments, and you need instruments in order to do that. So when the Supreme Court talks about money and speech, you need money to be able to buy an ad or to make a movie or to purchase a microphone or to drive a car with a bullhorn down the street. And the third thing with respect to the briefing point, I'll just spend a moment on this. We took the position right from the beginning that this prohibition, because it was so broad, because it was a facial challenge to a statute that criminalized people who were attending to express an opinion, and it would have covered books, any book published by a corporation at any time within this election period, if there was money in there, and most of our major publishers are corporations. So those are three quick ones, and we could go. Don't let him do it.
It turned out there was actually.
I think in fairness, we ought to point out that the facial challenge was dismissed by Citizens United and was not included in the questions presented that you originally presented.
But it was included in our brief. The court decided it had to get to that point.
They wanted to get to that point. They didn't have to get to that
they
point.
They thought they had.
David made the point a minute ago that these are all lawyers who haven't necessarily dealt deeply with corporate law. One of the complaints of Citizens United about Citizens United was that also that they are all lawyers with zero experience of politics as it's practiced in the real world. And one of the debates about the decision is whether the five justices really didn't understand politics the way it's practiced, or that they just understand it too well, or that they just have to be, by virtue of their roles, indifferent to the way politics is practiced. And specifically, one of the effects of Citizens United was to enable the creation of the super PAC. And the court said in the course of this, the majority said that this wouldn't be a potential source of corruption because by definition, these were organizations that wouldn't coordinate with the campaign. Therefore, there could be no possibility of corruption. In the world we live in, we have a completely broken regulatory system. The FEC doesn't actually act to enforce the rules on coordination, and there is very increasingly close coordination. So, Ted, maybe to begin with you again, is that just not within the proper ambit of the court's consideration?
Well, in the first place, the idea that the justices aren't politicians. We did have a whole court full of politicians in the 50s, ex-senators, and so forth. The last member of the Supreme Court to hold elective office was Justice O'Connor, and she's gone. But the justices aren't patent lawyers either, or antitrust lawyers, or equal protection lawyers, or ERISA lawyers, or anything. They are generalists. They have to decide. They decide 75 cases a year involving everything. And so that really you can't, I mean, I don't think you can make much of that point. With respect to
specifically they said an independent expenditure is political speech presented to the electorate that is not coordinated with the candidate.
So if there's a coordination, it is covered by a particular statute. Now, these statutes are very, very difficult to enforce because if I go out and I read what candidate A is saying and what his people are saying, and I then buy an ad in a magazine or a newspaper, I'm expressing my own ideas. I'm not being told what to do by that candidate. And these have to be genuinely independent. Now, as a factual matter, are they in a particular case? That's something else. And I guess many times you could make the argument that there is coordination, subliminal, under the surface coordination, but if it is an independent coordination, what the Supreme Court was saying, we're applying what the court calls strict scrutiny to regulations of speech. That means that we have to really find that the government has proven a compelling governmental interest to impose the restriction, and then the restriction has to be narrowly tailored to achieve that compelling governmental interest. Now, as I said at the beginning, this was an extraordinarily broad statute with criminal penalties that covered any manner of speech by corporations. And what the court says, we've got to find a compelling interest in order to justify it. Corruption, actual quid pro quo corruption would do it. The appearance of corruption is too elusive, and this and the idea
that is the standard in Buckley, though, isn't it?
With respect to contributions,
okay.
But not with okay. respect to expenditures. The Buckley case, which was 1976, which came after in the wake of Watergate, distinguished between expenditures and contributions. Now, you could make an argument, I have at times, that there shouldn't be any restriction or differentiation between contributions and expenditures. The whole point is to advance your idea of what politics should be. But with respect to independent expenditures, the court says it's too elusive to show that there's corruption. There might be corrupt motives, but because you want to curry favor with a candidate for office or someone running for office, that's what everybody does, you know, in all kinds of political process. So we can't start restricting speech because someone's trying to be on the good side of a candidate for office. So it was that's one of the reasons why the court said independent expenditures are different, and they went back to that Buckley decision in 1976. That was a relatively consistent theme throughout the court decisions up until Citizens United.
I think one of the dangers here is that we talk about this too much in the abstract,
yeah.
and we ignore what the reality is on the ground. I mean, the reality is on the ground that when this happens, money absolutely swamps the political process. And we're beginning to see that. And we're going to have a presidential election in which we're probably going to spend $2 billion on that. And that's a, in some senses, a horrific sum. But I think that's actually not the real problem. The real problem is not at the presidential stage, because at the presidential stage, the two major candidates are somehow going to raise enough money to get their message out. The real problem is at the state and local level, where an infusion of a certain amount of money can totally swamp what is otherwise happening. And what it allows is it allows corporations to fund that in a way that has not traditionally been done, and that I think undermines the democratic process. I mean, the thing about the democratic process is the thing that we're most afraid of is the government controlling it. But the thing that we're second most afraid of is private concentrations of power derailing it. And I think that the Citizens United case simply missed the reality of what that decision was going to create. The idea that these are independent contributions and that they're not coordinated, I think just doesn't reflect the reality of what happens.
So, the $2 billion that David talks about, the $4 billion, whatever the number is, a very, very small amount of that comes from corporations or major corporations. Most of it comes from wealthy individuals and people making contributions in that way, and so that really has nothing to do with Citizens United.
But we don't know
and
that.
Actually, David, do you have an objection to wealthy individuals as opposed to corporations funding independently?
Let's go through your client list.
Yeah, go through my client list. Well, with full disclosure, I reluctantly made the largest political contribution that I've ever made in the last presidential election cycle, a contribution that I think should have been banned because it was too large.
And your kids thought so.
My kids thought so too. Because I think one of the dangers is that you get into an arms race with money. But I do think that there ought to be limits on what is spent in political campaigns. I think there are two really difficult questions. There are two questions. One is really difficult, and the other one I think is not so difficult. The first question is, what should those limits be? How should you go about regulating campaign financing? That's a really difficult question. That's not a simple question. It requires the balancing of a lot of considerations. And historically, over the history of our country, we have not done a perfect job of that. I think we did a better job before Citizens United than now, but we've not done a perfect job of that. The second question is, who ought to make those decisions? And those decisions, I think, ought to be made primarily by the legislature that's in a much better position to balance those competing considerations. For example, one of the things that the majority says in Citizens United is that there is this kind of danger with respect to contributions to political candidates, but there's less of a danger in independent expenditures. How do you know that? Who knows that? How do you find that out? That's not something that courts are well designed to determine. Courts are well designed to establish basic principles. Now, if you believe that speech and money are the same thing, that money is speech, and if you believe that corporations are people, and if you believe that there should be no limitations on speech, then it follows that there should be no limitations on campaign contributions. Right. But if you believe that speech and money are different, that speech, like the microphone, enables speech, money like the microphone enables speech, but it is not speech itself. And if you believe that corporations really are different, then the syllogism breaks down. And then the court has already recognized that it's appropriate to have some regulation of campaign contributions. So it's not a question of should you have some regulation, it's a question of what should those regulations be and who should make those regulations. Should it be made by the legislature, made by the court?
So one of the things that is an issue here, if you decide that Congress, the legislature, should make these limits, is that when the legislature does that, they impose limits that favor incumbents. Those limits necessarily favor people that have a lot of money. They favor people whose name is Kennedy or Bush or Clinton or attractive people and that sort of thing. But the incumbency situation is particularly acute with respect to Congress imposing limits on the facilities of speech, imposing limits on signs. The Supreme Court decided unanimously just a week or so ago, struck down a sign ordinance because it distinguished between who was imposing the message, who was communicating, what time of day, what the event was. The Supreme Court said, we can't get into that. The government can't get into that because then it's choosing sides with respect to who will speak, who will have influence, and who won't.
So, David's already implicitly answered this question, no, so it's fair for me to ask you a yes or no question, Ted. Do you think the system we have now today is okay? Are you satisfied with where we find ourselves?
Well, it depends upon the alternative.
Where I was going.
Could it be improved? Is that the question?
Let's skip forward a couple of steps and pretend you had a clean sheet of paper and the constitutional constraints as you understand them. How would you design the perfect campaign?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, if I can answer it this way. At the time Citizens United was decided, they were looking at the rules and restrictions imposed by the Federal Election Commission. Mm-hmm. And you had to comply with these rules in order to be consistent with the law, in order to be not prosecuted. What the court pointed out is that the existing regulations divided speech into 33 types of speech. There were 568 pages of regulations, 1,278 pages of explanations, 1,771 advisory opinions since 1975. So if you were running for office or you were interested in supporting someone from running for office, you had to have a lawyer to explain all of this and hope that you got it right. So I start from the base proposition that the more speech we have, the better. That's what the framers of the Constitution thought. It might be nasty speech, it might be unpleasant speech, it might make you uncomfortable, it might make you hate the person who's giving the speech. But the answer to that is the marketplace of ideas. So if you start from the proposition that the First Amendment is very simple, Congress shall make no law restricting or inhibiting freedom of speech or the press. So now if Congress is making a law that the First Amendment says Congress shall not make, you'd better have a really good reason to restrict that marketplace of robust, vigorous debate and ideas. And if there's too much money in politics, I don't know the number, but I saw it once, and someone talked about the amount of money spent on candy at Halloween or Easter. Or deodorant. What are people spent? Maybe they should spend more on that. I don't know. But But these things have to be put in perspective. And if your baseline is that rich people can spend a lot of money on this side, and David, you probably can guess which side David's big contribution went to. But go ahead, the applause. There are people out there, but not very many in this audience, that were giving similar amounts of money to the other side. Eric Cantor, who was the minority leader in the House, outspent his opponent, little college professor down in the middle of Virginia, outspent his opponent 16 times to one, and he lost. You know, I mean, it was a big shock. But money doesn't always change the outcome of elections. But the baseline, if speech that you don't like, speech that other people like to speak and you'd rather they not speak, all of those things, you have to start with the proposition is, how am I going to restrict it consistent with the baseline political view in this country that crazy ideas, good ideas, too many ideas, people write long books, people make long movies, there's too much of that. I hate those things. But that's the price we pay for the freedom that we have.
So what I'm hearing is a system where there really are no limits on contributions.
Well, so the question was, are there limits on contributions?
No, I'm saying, like you're saying a wide open system.
I think if you put limits on contributions, you make it tougher on the outsider, because the incumbent will always have an advantage. Mm-hmm. When you put limits, you say the speech will be equated. It will be an equalizer. That the Supreme Court rejected that. We're not going to pick who gets to do more speech or less speech. And so if the choice is the government telling certain speakers that they can only spend so much money on their idea, that I believe in the idea should be judged on its merits, not who spent the money to put the idea in front of
it. But the only way you do that is by having some realistic limits on financing. Because this is not a situation in which anybody is saying you can't have ideas or you can't debate ideas. The question is, do you allow certain centers of wealth to so overwhelm the political process that those are the only ideas that essentially get through? And we have, nobody is saying people, rich people, poor people, anybody, ought not to be able to express their ideas. The question is, what is a reasonable amount of money to be able to spend? And there continues to be, I think, a fundamental issue. Everybody believes in speech. The question is whether money and speech are equivalent, whether money is speech or not. I don't think money is speech. I think money helps facilitate speech. I think money can also help derail speech. I think money can help obscure speech. I think money can do a whole lot of things, some good and some bad. And I think that when you have a political process that is so dependent on financing, if you allow unlimited financial contributions, you tilt the political system so much in one direction that that's undesirable. I think the point that you make about incumbency is an important one. I think that the Cantor, example shows that incumbency can be overcome even with substantially differential spending. But I think that overall, in the general situation, you've got to deal with the problem of incumbency. But I think the incumbents are not going to be able to hold down the outsiders. The outsiders may need more money, but they can raise more money as long as they raise it from more people. The question is whether one individual or one group of individuals or one large corporation ought to be able to dominate the process. And with respect to large corporations, we don't know how much money the large corporations are putting in, because they're put under the current system, they can put it into nonprofit organizations that don't have to disclose who is making their contributions. So we don't know for this election cycle how much money is going to be contributed by large corporations.
I'd like to come back to the idea of disclosure in just a second, and then I'll open it up to you guys. But first, David, I'd love to hear you respond to Ted's practical argument. You both are talking about principles of politics and then politics as it's practiced. And one of the points Ted made is that inevitably we wind up with this vast thicket of regulations and the government trying to make distinctions among potential political actors, mm-hmm. that hugely burdens campaigns and introduces tremendous friction into the practice of politics is just unhelpful to the democracy.
I think there's no doubt that the Federal Election Commission was a broken institution. But that wasn't what was involved in Citizens United, and that's not what's really involved in the basic debate here. Because it's not hard to have a rule that says the maximum amount that you're going to be able to contribute during 60 days before an election is X amount. That's not hard to define. That's not hard to enforce. You don't need hundreds of pages of regulations on that. So there are simple steps that you can take that eliminate, for example, political contributions from corporations and unions, which existed for a long time.
And still exist.
To candidates, but they can make independent expenditures. And what I'm saying is you could have the same kind of limitations on independent expenditures. I don't happen to think that the independent expenditure is that different than the contribution to the candidate. Mm-hmm. And I think in some cases it's worse, because to the extent it's different, it transfers responsibility, it transfers authority, it transfers power away from the candidate, away from the parties, and to all of these individual interests. And those interests are on the left and the right. But I think it is undesirable to weaken the party system, to weaken the candidate, and put that power on the outside.
So David said before about, to great applause, that we should be talking about the specifics instead of the abstract. Citizens United was a small, independent, nonprofit corporation, ideological corporation. They said exactly who they were. They were on the right side of the political spectrum with an expenditure of money, which wasn't very much. They made a 90-minute documentary addressing whether they thought Hillary Clinton was qualified to be president of the United States. 1% of their resources came from corporations. So this tiny little corporation that wanted to make a documentary about whether they thought Hillary Clinton was a good candidate or not for president was subject to criminal penalties. And you say the FEC didn't have anything to do with it. They went to the FEC for an advisory opinion. They couldn't get an answer for 2 years. And at the same time, hanging over their head is a 5-year conviction of a felony if they broadcast that documentary. That documentary, in my opinion, if you want to talk about specifics, ought to be out there in the marketplace of ideas. And the person who put together Citizens United said, I want to be like Michael Moore. Michael Moore does this. God bless him. You know, there should be those kind of ideas out there.
And as I said right at the beginning, if the Supreme Court had limited itself to the exact question that was presented in Citizens United, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation.
And we'd have a Supreme Court case for everybody who wanted to make a documentary
If all they're talking about is making documentaries, that's
so you distinguish between documentaries and billboards?
I don't think that was a documentary, and I don't distinguish between billboards, because I think people can put up billboards. I think the question is, how much money can you spend? How much money can corporations in particular spend? And remember, remember that Citizens United may have been a small nonprofit corporation, but what the Supreme Court did was they used that case as a vehicle to eliminate any limitation on for-profit corporations, whether it's General Electric or General Motors or Apple, some of whom I agree with and some of whom I disagree with in terms of their political contributions. But all of them are for-profit corporations, and I think all of them have the potential to distort the political process. And the court didn't have to reach that decision. It reached that decision because it wanted to change the way that politics were financed.
It had to deal with a statute, David, that prohibited all corporations.
All right. Let's if we could stay with the marketplace of ideas for a second. I would like to ask a question about disclosure and then go to these guys. I mean, 8 of 9 justices in Citizens United were in favor of disclosure. I think only Justice Thomas dissented on that point. And they seem to assume that it was actually already taking place, which it's not. In a lot of cases, again, now it's really a problem now at the IRS rather than the FEC, which is not enforcing arguably some regulations. Are you guys in favor? Do you see disclosure as a possible solution here? And do you think the government can legally compel it?
Well, I favor disclosure. I think that particularly if corporations are going to use shareholder money for political purposes. I think the shareholders ought to have an opportunity to know how their money is being used. I think people in the political arena ought to have knowledge about who is sponsoring a particular idea. I think that if you simply look at Citizens United, as you say, you've got 8 out of the 9 justices who seem to think it's appropriate to have that kind of disclosure. So I think it's desirable. I think you can have it. I think you don't have it now. And I think even the extent to which you do have it now, there is some, in my view, misguided efforts in Congress to eliminate that kind of disclosure. But I think if you're going to have this kind of system, disclosure is an absolute must. And I think that that underpinned Justice Kennedy's opinion.
So it depends upon what disclosure, when, the details of the disclosure. The Supreme Court upheld disclosure requirements in Citizens United. Not a lot of time was spent on briefing or arguing that. But a couple of years before, it struck down, I think unanimously, an ordinance in Ohio that that was a municipal ordinance that required persons circulating a petition to want to change their city government to have to disclose where the money came from to circulate the petitions and so forth. And the Supreme Court struck that down because the court felt, agreed with the arguments, that that was going to be an intimidating factor with respect to the person trying to overthrow the local government. Earlier than that, in a case called NAACP versus Button, the Supreme Court struck down disclosure requirements aimed at the NAACP because those disclosures of members and supporters of the NAACP were being used to intimidate people in southern communities and during civil rights battles. So it's what kind of disclosure are you talking about? When is it, how burdensome is it? In many cases it's burdensome. Is it even-handed? And all of those things. So disclosure is, I think there's good things about disclosure, but there are also potential issues with respect to it, and we're talking about the expression of ideas. So we don't want to intimidate people from doing this, but on the other hand, it is probably a good thing where people are investing large amounts of money with candidates or something like that for people to know who is out there expressing this idea. At the end of the day, however, I think the idea ought to stand or fall on its own and not who likes that idea.
I can't. I have to, Ted, quote to you Justice Scalia and on this issue of disclosure. It's always this one line, which I find very powerful. And he said, requiring people to stand up in public for their political acts fosters civic courage, without which democracy is doomed. For my part, I do not look forward to a society which campaigns anonymously and even exercises the direct democracy of initiative and referendum, hidden from public scrutiny and protected from the accountability of criticism. This does not resemble the home of the brave.
Yes, so that's true. But the Federalist Papers that founded the Constitution, that supported the enactment of the Constitution, were written under assumed names. The people who wrote that, Hamilton J. Jefferson, or Madison rather, did that in secret. The Constitutional Convention was closed to the public. So there, yes, it's really important that people get it. That's why people like David and I like getting involved in these discussions, because we're willing to stand up and be heard and take positions, popular or not. Last night, we were both popular. Tonight, only David's popular. But I do think
we take turns.
I do think it's a good thing for people to be uninhibited and unafraid of participating and standing up for their ideas, and that's Scalia's point. But there are times because those patriots who wrote the Federalist Papers were afraid of what the British troops would do to them or the remnants of the supporters of the British Empire would do to them in connection with the, and the anti-federalists, both the Federalists and the anti-federalists put out papers under assumed names to try to convince the electorate. So sometimes it's an appropriate thing.
Do you want to respond to that before
no,
we go to the
I agree. I think if you're talking about the situation in, during the aftermath of the Revolution, or you're talking about the civil rights struggle in the South, or perhaps in some other instances, and you've got individuals who are participating in the political process that are subject to attack, I think you need to be conscious of that. I don't think that, I think as Ted says, I don't think that carries over into when you're talking about very, very large political contributions, very, very large public corporations. I don't think those are the kind of people that need that kind of protection from disclosure.
All right, let me go to you guys. Please, there are microphones circulating, and please do, as we always say, ask your question in the form of a question, so we can, why don't we go here, please.
Thank you very much. Outside of about 20 billionaires in this country, ain't nobody happy with this decision.
Can you bring the microphone a little closer?
I'm sorry. It's a very unpopular decision, except for about 20 billionaires. There is not transparency. All the firewalls are breaking down. Something has to be done, practically. Something has to be done. And I want to ask Ted, are there any solutions you see that Congress can make, or is it all tied up in speech?
So it's a good question, because, and we talked about this before we came out here, because you feel that, yeah. The people of this country, and believe me, I feel it when any of the subject Citizens United comes up anytime I'm in a room. So it's an unpopular thing. People are concerned about this. They're not concerned about it for no reason. It's a good reason. People are a feel that people have advantage, and they're taking advantage of imposing an enormous amount of money in the process and tilting the balance. Now, Citizens United applied its corporations and labor unions. So labor unions, some of the biggest participants in the electoral process are the Service Employees International Union, the Teachers Union, and so forth. So when we're talking about what can Congress do about vast amounts of money, and it includes not just money, but get out the vote, sending people into precincts, and all of those things, which is facilitated by money. So it is a difficult thing to do when you start with the baseline of which is worse. Billionaires spending money, by the way, one of the figures in the Citizens United case is that 96% of the corporations in the United States have 100 or fewer employees. So we're not talking about, when you talk about corporations, there's large corporations with lots of money, and there's lots of small corporations that might care about the environmental laws or the trade laws or who gets elected governor and those sorts of things. So that it's a difficult question, it's a legitimate question, and I think David maybe have a better answer than, as far as you're concerned anyway, a better answer to this question. But I have to think about its speech, its ideas, it's the flow of information, and too many speech, too much speech. I had one case, I'll just give you one example. It was with the ACLU. I was on the same side of the ACLU. I was in California fighting a city ordinance that restricted the number of newspaper racks on the city street. And the city of Burbank felt there were too many of those things. They were an aesthetic nuisance, and they should be cut down to one or two news racks. And I was defending the newspaper association and liked those news racks for obvious reasons. The guy from the ACLU got up and said, all those news racks on the corner, they think they're ugly. I think that's beautiful. So many choices.
Well, I think choices are good. I think choices among ideas are good. I don't think that necessarily translates into unlimited political contributions. I think the answer to your question is that there's very little that Congress can do, I think, consistent with the Citizens United case. I think disclosure is one of those things. I think public financing of elections is another. But I think if you think that Citizens United is a bad decision, the best way to deal with that is to make sure that the next president is somebody who will appoint a justice who is more likely to vote to restore Austin.
And David will make large contributions to make sure that happens.
Can we go over here?
Hi, my name is Bruce McEver. It seems that we're missing the elephant in the room, and that is that this whole political contribution thing is distorting our legislative process. Because congressmen and senators are spending most of their time raising money. And it's the time that it takes. It's also, it's not only the speech. I like the speech, but it's the speech, but the time that we allow this to happen, how it's funded. We are wrecking our whole democratic process through, you know, we're just crying for campaign reform. And I don't know why we can't fix that. It's not the legislature, the people that are in the office that's got to fix it. I think it's ourselves that have to fix this. And I think we've got a real problem. If you look at the gridlock and what's going on, it would be very hard to be a legislator today. My hat's off to them. But they're basically fundraising machines. They're not thinking about what they have to do to run the country. Or strategically, you can't do it and raise the amount of money you got to raise to do one of these campaigns. Yeah.
I think all that is true. Now, I think that that was unfortunately true before Citizens United, and I think it will be true even if Citizens United is eliminated. I think until you get public financing of elections, I don't see a solution to that.
Ted, do you see any solution besides public financing?
The public financing of elections raises a whole hassle of issues of people using your taxpayers' money to support people that you don't agree with, which also raises First Amendment issues. But it's a really good point. They are spending all their time on this. And as recipients, maybe what you should all do is never make another contribution again. All of you. And make so because if you're giving the money, they will be asking you for it. So, and we get these things. Once you make a contribution, you're on their list forever. You know, I mean, and it's not just the person to whom you made the contribution. It's everybody on the gets a hold of the list and so forth. One of the things we have in this country that we haven't talked about, and it does affect how much money is involved in this, is how long we have campaigns. Yes. We have campaigns. Absolutely. The next presidential election will start on November, whatever it is, 2016, and the congressional elections are going full time. In other countries of the world, there's shorter election cycles. Those raise issues about First Amendment.
Yeah, how could you possibly? And
they do, and that's one of the things why we don't have it. The political parties would like to shorten up the cycle because it costs them a lot of money. The Republican Party now is struggling with this idea, what are we gonna do with 16, 18, 20 candidates on debates and so forth. But I mean, that's another issue that fuels the need for funds because it goes on so long and so forth. I do not have an answer to that. Unless David's right and you put public money, and then when you do that, you're gonna have to stop people from spending their own money. And so or at least limit the amount of money. So you're gonna have to have restrictions on how much money you can raise from the public if you're taking public money. That hasn't worked out too well. Obama rejected the public funding very successfully.
Let's go back in the back of the room there, please. Behind you.
Hi, Tina Walls. A quick question about term limits. Would that help? And if so, is there a pathway to term limits on the federal level?
I think term limits help eliminate or reduce the effect of the incumbency advantage that Ted was talking about. I'm not a big fan of term limits. I think that particularly with government as complicated as it is, if you're going to have term limits, you need to give people enough time to actually get into office and accomplish something. I think that in terms of financing, I think that term limits I don't see how term limits really affect the financing issue.
I don't think it would affect it too much either. One of the, and I'll say this is just a point with respect to term limits. What you find frequently at state governments when you have term limits is that the staff of those committees and they stay there forever and they have more power. Right. Their power increases and the elected officials' power decrease in proportion.
Right.
We need time for another question here. Can we go here, please? There's a microphone coming.
given the reality of how Citizens United has morphed, so every candidate has their political action committee, wouldn't we just be better off to just say, in every day that a candidate gets money, whatever it is, no limits, it has to be disclosed. We have the technology to do it, and just call it as it is. This is the way it is. I'm not saying it's wrong, it's right. This is the way it is. Wouldn't we be better off with, you know, what was it, sunlight shining through and just calling it in reality, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, whether you like it or not. Right. And I do think that with modern technology, you could force, the minute the money went into the bank account, the disclosure would be on the website or whatever of that candidate or that person running for office. It doesn't answer all the other questions about disclosure and so forth, but if you wanted to do it, rather than wait 3 months and then have a report after the election, and some of these reports do come after the election, and there's this, the way it is now, there's a cycle, so it's a such and such June 30th is a reporting date, so everybody's, give me some more money, I gotta show that I'm really strong, and I'm exactly. So that sort of thing. So there's a lot of flaws in this system as it exists.
But Ted, just to be clear, you don't think that should necessarily apply to outside, so-called outside groups?
Well,
the same compulsion to immediately disclose.
What is an outside group? Everybody's an outside group, and people talk. I see editorials about outside groups, outside interests, special interests. You know, what is a special interest? Everybody has their own interests.
We want
to elect people that reflect your views and advance your economic position or what you think is a social position. So there's all kinds of special interests here. I will say one more thing about Citizens United before I forget it. When we argued Citizens United, friend of the court briefs were filed on behalf of Citizens United to support the decision that ultimately came down from the ACLU, from very, very libertarian groups that wanted to protect freedom under the First Amendment. I'm just saying that to make the point that there's lots of points of view here. And it isn't all just one. It wasn't all big corporations. We weren't getting any amicus briefs from big corporations. Whatever you say about whether big, you don't know how much big corporations, they don't really want to be involved in this process. They don't want to spend the money. They don't want to take positions that might turn out to be controversial. Not all of them. But, I mean, that's an issue for big corporations. It's the smaller ones that you maybe affect who's going to be the mayor of the small community. And that Austin case you talked about involved a state law restricting how much money could be spent for people running for state or local offices. And that's where the money hits the road. I mean, the small chamber of commerce in a particular community has a lot of stake in the zoning ordinances or the development ordinances or things like that. And they may be protecting their stockholders, but their stockholders are themselves, these small corporations.
But if you're dealing with that, you can deal with that by just having a contribution limit that allows small corporations to have a reasonable amount of money that they contribute. With respect to the question, I'm in favor of all disclosure. I think inside groups, outside groups, everybody ought to disclose. If you're contributing to a candidate, you ought to be prepared to disclose that you're contributing to a candidate. That's what you have to do right now. I think that's what you ought to have to do with independent financing.
Let's go back there for one more quick question, please. Yeah, back over here. If we can get the microphone there.
Throw it like you do popcorn.
I wanted to just mention a fact that may be of interest to all of you on the dais. The issue is corporation, but perhaps less and less the corporations per se. In the last election, the actual number was closer to $9 billion, total number spent on the elections in the cycle. Now, 50% of that has been counted to under 200 individuals. So the question is, if you project into the future and the impact, perhaps the spiritual impact to the First Amendment and to democracy, how can we say that free speech really can exist when the vast majority of supporting an idea, good, bad, or indifferent, on both sides of the aisle, when the focus is concentrated so vastly.
I fundamentally agree that contributions.
I think you're one of those 200 people. Yeah.
No, I did. I did the arithmetic in my head, and I was. I wasn't even getting close. But doing the arithmetic in my head, and the fact that I wasn't even close suggests to me how much money people are putting into those campaigns. I think you really just raised the same question we've been talking about throughout this. Is yes, that's a problem, but how do you solve it? I think everybody recognizes that. It would be better not to have that kind of money swamping the political system. But on the other hand, I think everybody recognizes that there are problems in terms of how you regulate, how you restrict it in a way that does not do damage to our political system.
It is a good place to end, and we do need to end in a minute, Ted. And maybe, though, because I think this is a concern of a lot of people, this is a fundamental dividing question that we keep coming back to about whether money is simply speech and therefore cannot be regulated. But I think what the gentleman is saying is that do you wind up in a world where some speakers are simply able to completely overwhelm everybody else? And is that itself become a free speech problem?
I don't know whether it's a lot of money by a small number of people, how they're divided on which side of the political spectrum and the extent to which one amount of money for this side is counterbalanced by a lot of money on the other side, and people that are in favor of internet gambling are balanced by the people that are opposed to internet gambling, all of those things. I think that's very hard to determine. So that it then comes to the point where you, as David says, contribution limits, but then contribution limits are pretty much covered to a certain degree. They're still constitutional, whether they should be or not, with this current makeup of the court. They did just uphold restrictions on contributions to judicial elections in Florida in a case that came down a couple weeks ago. So the question is, I mean, are you going to, and then when you distinguish between a contribution and someone who thinks that we're producing too much carbon, will spend a lot of money to support initiatives and therefore, and also candidates who will do something about climate change. Now, do we want to inhibit people from doing that if the spillover effect is having impact on people that will support measures to deal with climate change? This is a complicated subject, and when it gets into the idea of the limitation or government regulation, you will inevitably get regulations like I was talking about from the Federal Election Commission. At the margin, people are very clever. My favorite aphorism is that you can't make anything foolproof because fools are so ingenious. So when you start putting restrictions on people's ability, directly or indirectly, with microphone speech, billboards, contributions to organizations that support the things they support, support for labor unions because of you believe in that, whatever it is, when you put limitation, government restrictions on that sort of thing, people are going to find ways around it because people have the instinct in this country because they want to be heard. That's why you're all here, because this is an important issue and the ideas that we're talking about are important, and there's a lot to be said on both sides of these issues. So when government, that's why I start with the presumption, you prove it to me that this doesn't restrict speech, and don't tell me there's too much speech, because that's not a good argument. Now, that's just me. But I think that is the issue, those are the issues that we're talking about, and there's legitimate points of view on both sides, no question about this thing, and maybe something should be done about it, but until I can see something that is reasonably effective, that treats everybody fairly, in terms of however rich or poor you are, however good-looking you are, or however much of an incumbent you are, you get to speak as much as you want to speak. So these are difficult issues and important ones.
Well, I regret that there's a restriction on this conversation, but we've reached it. Thank you guys very much.